This is Audible.
Penguin Random House Audio presents Home Fire by Carmela Shamsi. Read for you by Tanya Rodriguez. For Gillian Slovo. The ones we love are enemies of the state. Sophocles, Antigone. Translated by Seamus Heaney. Isma. Chapter 1. Isma was going to miss her flight. The ticket wouldn't be refunded because the airline took no responsibility for passengers who arrived at the airport 3 hours ahead of the departure time and were escorted to an interrogation room. She had expected the interrogation, but not the hours of waiting that would precede it, nor that it would feel so humiliating to have the contents of her suitcase inspected. She'd made sure not to pack anything that would invite comment or questions. No Quran, no family pictures, no books on her area of academic interest. But even so, the officer took hold of every item of Isma's clothing and ran it between her thumb and fingers, not so much searching for hidden pockets as judging the quality of the material. Finally, she reached for the designer-labeled down jacket Isma had folded over a chair back when she entered, and held it up, one hand pinching each shoulder. "This isn't yours," she said. And Isma was sure she didn't mean because it's at least a size too large, but rather, it's too nice for someone like you. "I used to work at a dry cleaning shop. The woman who brought this in said she didn't want it when we couldn't get rid of the stain." She pointed to the grease mark on the pocket.
"Does the manager know you took it?"
"I was the manager."
"You were the manager of a dry cleaning shop, and now you're on your way to a PhD program in sociology?"
"Yes."
"And how did that happen?"
"My siblings and I were orphaned just after I finished uni. They were 12 years old, twins. I took the first job I could find. Now they've grown up, I can go back to my life."
"You're going back to your life? In Amherst, Massachusetts?"
"I meant the academic life. My former tutor from LSE teaches in Amherst now, at the university there. Her name is Hira Shah. You can call her. I'll be staying with her when I arrive, until I find a place of my own."
"In Amherst?"
"No, I don't know. Sorry, do you mean her place, or the place of my own? She lives in Northampton. That's close to Amherst. I'll look all around the area for whatever suits me best. So it might be Amherst, but it might not. There are some real estate listings on my phone, which you have."
She stopped herself. The official was doing that thing that she'd encountered before in security personnel, staying quiet when you answered their question in a straightforward manner, which made you think you had to say more. And the more you said, the more guilty you sounded.
The woman dropped the jacket into the jumble of clothes and shoes and told Isma to wait. That had been a while ago. The plane would be boarding now. Isma looked over at the suitcase. She'd repacked when the woman left the room and spent the time since worrying if doing that without permission constituted an offense. Should she empty the clothes out into a haphazard pile, or would that make things even worse? She stood up, unzipped the suitcase, and flipped it open so its contents were visible. A man entered the office, carrying Isma's passport, laptop, and phone. She allowed herself to hope, but he sat down, gestured for her to do the same, and placed a voice recorder between them.
"Do you consider yourself British?"
the man said.
"I am British." "But do you consider yourself British?"
"I've lived here all my life." She meant there was no other country of which she could feel herself a part, but the words came out sounding evasive.
The interrogation continued for nearly 2 hours. He wanted to know her thoughts on Shias, homosexuals, the Queen, democracy, the Great British Bake Off, the invasion of Iraq, Israel, suicide bombers, dating websites. After that early slip regarding her Britishness, she settled into the manner that she'd practiced, with Annika playing the role of the interrogating officer, Isma responding to her sister as though she were a customer of dubious political opinions whose business Isma didn't want to lose by voicing strenuously opposing views, but to whom she didn't see the need to lie, either. When people talk about the enmity between Shias and Sunni, it usually centers around some political imbalance of power, such as in Iraq or Syria. As a Brit, I don't distinguish between one Muslim and another. Occupying other people's territory generally causes more problems than it solves. This served for both Iraq and Israel. Killing civilians is sinful. That's equally true, whether the manner of killing is a suicide bombing or aerial bombardments or drone strikes. There were long intervals of silence between each answer and the next question as the man clicked keys on her laptop, examining her browser history. He knew that she was interested in the marital status of an actor from a popular TV series, that wearing a hijab didn't stop her from buying expensive products to tame her frizzy hair, that she had searched for how to make small talk with Americans. "You know, you don't have to be so compliant about everything," Annika had said during the role-playing. Isma's sister, not quite 19, with her law student brain, who knew everything about her rights and nothing about the fragility of her place in the world. For instance, if they ask you about the Queen, just say, "As an Asian, I have to admire her color palette." It's important to show at least a tiny bit of contempt for the whole process. Instead, Isma had responded, "I greatly admire Her Majesty's commitment to her role." But there had been comfort in hearing her sister's alternative answers in her head. Her "ha" of triumph when the official asked a question that she'd anticipated and Isma had dismissed, such as the Great British Bake Off one. Well, if they didn't let her board this plane, or anyone after this, she would go home to Annika, which is what half Isma's heart knew it should do in any case. How much of Annika's heart wanted that was a hard question to answer. She'd been so adamant that Isma not change her plans for America, and whether this was selflessness or a wish to be left alone was something even Annika herself didn't seem to know. A tiny flicker in Isma's brain signaled a thought about Parvez that was trying to surface, before it was submerged by the strength of her refusal ever to think about him again. Eventually, the door opened, and the woman official walked in. Perhaps she would be the one to ask the family questions, the ones most difficult to answer, the most fraught when she'd prepared with her sister. "Sorry about that," the woman said, unconvincingly. "Just had to wait for America to wake up and confirm some details about your student visa. All checked out. Here." She handed a stiff rectangle of paper to Isma with an air of magnanimity. It was the boarding pass for the plane she'd already missed. Isma stood up, unsteady because of the pins and needles in her feet, which she'd been afraid to shake off in case she accidentally kicked the man across the desk from her. As she wheeled out her luggage, she thanked the woman whose thumbprints were on her underwear, not allowing even a shade of sarcasm to enter her voice. The cold bit down on every exposed piece of skin before cutting through the layers of clothing. Isma opened her mouth and tilted her head back, breathing in the lip-numbing, teeth-aching air. Crusted snow lay all about, glinting in the lights of the terminal. Leaving her suitcase with Dr. Hira Shah, who had driven 2 hours across Massachusetts to meet her at Logan Airport, she walked over to a mound of snow at the edge of the parking lot, took off her gloves, and pressed her fingertips down on it. At first, it resisted, but then it gave way, and her fingers burrowed into the softer layers beneath. She licked snow out of her palm, relieving the dryness of her mouth. The woman in customer services at Heathrow, a Muslim, had found her a place on the next flight out, without charge. She had spent the whole journey worrying about the interrogation awaiting her in Boston, certain they would detain her or put her on a plane back to London. But the immigration official had asked only where she was going to study, said something she didn't follow but tried to look interested in regarding the university basketball team, and waved her through. And then, as she walked out of the arrivals area, there was Dr. Shah, mentor and savior, unchanged since Isma's undergraduate days, except for a few silver strands threaded through her cropped dark hair. Seeing her raise a hand in welcome, Isma understood how it might have felt in another age to step out on deck and see the upstretched arm of the Statue of Liberty and know you had made it, you were going to be all right. While there was still some feeling in her gloveless hands, she typed a message into her phone. Arrived safely. Through security. No problems. Dr. Shah here. How things with you? Her sister wrote back. Fine. Now I know they've let you through. Really fine? Stop worrying about me. Go live your life. I really want you to. The parking lot, with large, confident vehicles, the broad avenues beyond, the lights gleaming everywhere, their brightness multiplied by reflecting surfaces of glass and snow. Here, there was swagger and certainty. And, on this New Year's Day of 2015, a promise of new beginnings. Isma awoke into light to see two figures leaving the sky and falling toward her, bright colors billowing above their heads. When Hira Shah had brought her to see this studio apartment, the morning after her arrival in America, the landlord had drawn attention to the skylight as a selling point to offset the dank built-in cupboard and promised her comets and lunar eclipses. With the memory of the Heathrow interrogation still jangling her nerves, she had been able to think only of surveillance satellites wheeling through the sky and had rejected the studio. But by the end of the day's viewings, it had become clear that she wouldn't be able to afford anything nicer without the encumbrance of a roommate. Now, some 10 weeks later, she could stretch out in the bed, knowing herself to be seeing but unseen. How slowly the parachutists seemed to move, trailing golds and reds. In almost all human history, figures descending from the sky would have been angels, or gods, or demons, or Icarus hurtling down, his father Daedalus following too slowly to catch the vainglorious boy. What must it have felt like to inhabit a commonality of human experience? All eyes to the sky, watching for something mythic to land. She took a picture of the parachutists and sent it to Annika with the caption, "Try this someday?" And then stepped out of bed, wondering if spring had arrived early or if this was merely a lull. Overnight, the temperature had climbed vertiginously, melting the snow into a river. She had heard it at her first waking for the dawn prayer as it rushed down the gentle slope of the street. It had been a winter of snowstorms, more than usual, she'd been told, and as she dressed, she imagined people exiting their homes and, on patches of ground glimpsed for the first time in months, finding lost items, a glove, keys, pens, and pennies. The weight of snow pressing familiarity out of the objects so that the glove, placed beside its former pair, looked no more than a distant relative. And what then do you do? Throw away both gloves? Or wear them mismatched to acknowledge the miracle of their reunion? She folded her pajamas and put them under her pillow, smoothed out the duvet, looked around the clean, spare lines of her apartment, single bed, desk and desk chair, chest of drawers. She felt, as she did most mornings, the deep pleasure of daily life distilled to the essentials. Books, walks, spaces in which to think and work. When she pushed open the heavy door of the two-story stone veneer house, the morning air was free of its hundred-blade knife for the first time. The thaw had widened the streets and sidewalks, and she felt, what was the word? Boundless. As she set off, walking at a pace that didn't worry about slipping on ice. Past double-storied colonial houses. Past cars announcing all their political beliefs on bumper stickers. Past vintage clothing. Past antiques and yoga. She turned onto Main Street, where City Hall, with its inexplicable Norman towers inset with arrow slits, gave the vista an edge of hilarity. She made her way into her favorite cafe and walked down the stairs with a mug in hand to the book-lined basement, a haven of warm lamplight, worn armchairs, and strong coffee. Punched keys on the keyboard to wake her laptop. Barely registered from over-familiarity, the desktop picture of her mother as a young woman of the 1980s, big hair and chunky earrings, dropping a kiss on Isma's infant scalp. As a matter of morning routine, she opened the Skype window to check if her sister was online. She wasn't, and Isma was about to click out when a new name appeared on the online contacts list. Pervez Pasha. Isma lifted her hands off the keyboard, set them down on either side of the laptop, and looked at her brother's name. She hadn't seen it here since that day in December, when he'd called to tell them the decision he'd made for his life without any consideration of what it would mean for his sisters. Now, he would be looking at her name, the green check mark next to it telling him she was available to chat. The Skype window was positioned so that her mother's lips were touching it. Zainab Pasha's slim, fine-boned features had skipped Isma and passed on to the twins, who laughed with their mother's mouth, smiled with their mother's eyes. Isma maximized the Skype window so it filled the entire screen, encircled her throat with the palms of her hands, and felt her heart's reaction to the sight of his name in the high-speed propulsion of blood through her arteries. The seconds passed, and there was nothing from him. She kept watching the screen, just as she knew he was watching his, both for the same reason, waiting for Annika. A few weeks earlier, at Hira Shah's condo, a strange music had cut through the sound of Hira slicing potatoes, a whistling, high-pitched twang. Isma and Hira checked phones and speakers, placed ears against walls and floorboards, stepped out into the corridor, opened closets, entered empty rooms, and still it kept on. Eerie loveliness, impossible to pinpoint as any known instrument, voice, or bird call. A neighbor stopped by, looking for the source. "Ghosts," he said, with a wink, before leaving. Isma laughed, but Hira drew her shoulders in tighter, reached out to touch the evil eye that hung on her wall, which Isma had always assumed to be merely decorative. The music kept on, coming from everywhere and nowhere, following them as they moved through the apartment. Hira, gripping her knife, whispered something that turned out to be the Lord's Prayer. She'd been educated at a convent school in Kashmir. Finally, the supremely rational, razor-minded Dr. Shah said they should go out for dinner, despite the unpleasant hail. Perhaps the sound would have stopped by the time they returned. Isma went upstairs to the bathroom to wash the grime of concealed corners off her hands. While standing at the sink, looking out of the window beside it, she saw the source of the music. Running down, she caught Hira's arm and pulled her out of the back door entrance, ducking her head against the hail. All along the red brick building, end to end, icicles hung from the eaves, a foot or more in length. Against these broadswords, pellets rained down and made music. The acoustics of ice on ice. A thing unimaginable until experienced. Pain swerved at her then, physical, bringing her to her knees. Hira moved toward her, but Isma held up a hand, lay back in the snow, and allowed the pain to roil through her while the hail and icicles continued their synthetic-edged symphony. Parvez, a boy never seen without his headphones and a mic, would have lain out here for as long as the song continued, the wet of snow seeping through his clothes, the thud of hail beating down on him, uncaring of anything except capturing something previously unheard, eyes hazy with pleasure. That had been the only time she had truly, purely missed her brother, without adjectives such as ungrateful and selfish slicing through the feeling of loss. Now she looked at his name on the screen, her mouth forming prayers to keep Annika from logging on, the adjectives thick in her mind. Annika must learn to think of him as lost forever. It was possible to do this with someone you loved. Isma had learned that early on. But you could learn it only if there was a complete vacuum where the other person had been. His name vanished from the screen. She touched her shoulder, muscles knotted beneath the skin, pressed down, and knew what it was to be without family. No one's hands but your own to minister to your suffering. "We'll be in touch all the time," she and Annika had said to each other in the weeks before she had left. But touch was the one thing modern technology didn't allow, and without it, she and her sister had lost something vital to their way of being together. Touch was where it had started with them. As an infant, Annika was bathed and changed and fed and rocked to sleep by her grandmother and 9-year-old sister, while Parvez, the weaker, sicklier twin, was the one who suckled at their mother's breast. She produced only enough milk for one, and cried unless she was the one to tend to him. When the twins grew older and formed their own self-enclosed universe, there was less and less Annika needed from Isma, but even so, there remained a physical closeness. Parvez was the person Annika talked to about all her griefs and worries, but it was Isma she came to for an embrace, or a hand to rub her back, or a body to curl up against on the sofa. And when the burden of the universe seemed too great for Isma to bear, particularly in those early days after their grandmother and mother had died within the space of a year, leaving Isma to parent and provide for 2 grief-struck 12-year-olds, it was Annika who would place her hands on her sister's shoulders and massage away the ache. Clicking her tongue against her teeth in remonstration of her self-pity, Isma pulled up the essay she was writing and returned to the refuge of work. By mid-afternoon, the temperature had passed the 50-degree Fahrenheit mark, which sounded, and felt, far warmer than 11 degrees Celsius, and a bout of spring madness had largely emptied the cafe basement. Isma tilted her post-lunch mug of coffee toward herself, touched the tip of her finger to the liquid, considered how much of a faux pas it might be to ask to have it microwaved. She had just decided she would risk the opprobrium when the door opened and the scent of cigarettes curled in from the smoking area outside, followed by a young man of startling looks. His looks weren't startling because they were exceptional. Thick dark hair, milky tea skin, well-proportioned features, good height, nice shoulders. Stand on any street corner in Wembley long enough and you'd see a version of this, though rarely attached to such an air of privilege. No, what was startling was the stomach-turning familiarity of the man's features. In her uncle's house, not an uncle by blood or even affection, merely by the habitual nature of his presence in her family's life, there was a photograph from the 1970s of a neighborhood cricket team posing with a trophy. It was a photograph Isma had sometimes stopped to look at as a child, wondering at the contrast between the glorious, swaggering boys and the unprepossessing middle-aged men they'd grown into. It was really only the ones she knew as middle-aged men she paid much attention to, and so she'd never given particular thought to the unsmiling one in the badly fitting clothes until the day her grandmother stood in front of the picture and said, "Shameless!" poking her finger at the young man. "Oh, yes, the new MP," the uncle said, coming to see what had drawn out a pronouncement of such uncharacteristic venom.
On the day of the final, we were a player short, and this one, Mr. Sirius, was visiting his cousin, our wicket-keeper, so we said, "Okay, you play for us," and gave him our injured batsman's uniform. Did nothing all match except drop a catch, and then ended up holding the trophy in this official photograph, which went into the local newspaper. We were just being polite to offer it to him, since he was an outsider, and only because we were sure he'd have enough manners to say thanks, but the captain, that was me, should be the one to hold it. We should have known then he would grow up to be a politician. £20 says he has it framed on his wall and tells everyone he was man of the match.
Later that day, Isma overheard her grandmother talking to her best friend and neighbor, Auntie Naseem, and learned the real reason for that shameless. It was not the unsmiling one's choice of career, but a cruelty he'd recently shown to their family when it would have been easy for him to act otherwise. In the years after that, she'd paid close attention to him, the only one in the picture to grow up slim and sharp, bigger and brighter trophies forever in his sights. And now, here he was, walking across the cafe floor, not the hated, admired figure he'd grown into, but a slightly older version of the boy posing with the team. Except his hair, floppier, and his expression, more open. This must be, had to be, the son. She'd seen a photo that included him as well, but he'd ducked his head so that the floppy hair obscured his features. She'd wondered then whether that was by design. Eamon, that was his name. How they'd laughed in Wembley when the newspaper article accompanying the family picture revealed this detail.
An Irish spelling to disguise a Muslim name. Eamon became Eamon, so that people would know the father had integrated. His Irish-American wife was seen as another indicator of this integrationist posing, rather than an explanation for the son's name. The son was standing at the counter, in blue jeans and a quilted olive-green jacket, waiting. She stood up, mug in hand, and walked over to him. "They only open up this counter when it's busy."
"Thanks, kind of you to say. Where is..." His vowels unashamedly posh, where she had expected the more class-obscuring London accent of his father. "Upstairs. I'll show you. I mean, I'm sure you understand upstairs. I should have said, I'm going there myself. Coffee's cold." Why so many words?
He took the mug from her hand with unexpected familiarity.
"Allow me. As thanks for rescuing me from being the Englishman who stood at the counter for all eternity, who you could be forgiven for confusing with the Englishman who gets lost going upstairs."
"I just want it heated up."
"Right you are."
He sniffed the contents of the mug, another over-familiar gesture.
"Smells amazing. What is it? I wouldn't know an Ethiopian from a Colombian if..."
He stopped.
"That sentence doesn't know where to go from there." "Probably just as well. It's the house brew." She stood where she was a moment, watching him walk up the stairs, which were bracketed on one side by potted ferns and on the other by a wall with ferns painted on it. When he glanced down toward her, mouthing, "Not lost yet," she pretended she had simply been preoccupied by her thoughts and returned to the little table in the alcove, angling her body so that her own shadow kept the sunlight from her computer screen. Slid her fingers over the wooden tabletop, its knots, its burns. "Guess who?" she started to type into her phone, then stopped and deleted it. She could too easily imagine the tone of Annika's response. "Ugh," she'd say, or, "Why did you even talk to him?" He didn't return. She imagined him seeing a short line at the counter and placing her mug down with a shrug before walking out the upstairs exit. It left her both vindicated and disappointed. She went up to buy herself another coffee and found that the machine had broken down, so had to settle for hot water and a tea bag that leaked color into it.
Returning downstairs, she saw a mug of fresh coffee at her table and a man folded into the chair next to it, legs thrown over the arm, reading a book in the shape of the gap in the bookshelf above his head.
"What is it?"
he said, looking at the cup of tea she set down on an empty table. He examined the tag at the end of the tea bag.
"Ruby red, not even pretending it's a flavor."
She held up the mug in thanks. The coffee wasn't as hot as it could have been, but he must have had to carry it down the street.
"How much do I owe you?"
5 minutes of conversation? That's what I spent standing in the queue. But after you're finished with whatever you're doing...
That could be a while.
Good. Gives me time to catch up on essential reading about...
He shut the book, looked at its cover.
"The Holy Book of Women's Mysteries, complete in one volume. Feminist witchcraft, goddess rituals, spell casting, and other womanly arts."
One of the undergraduates looked up, glared. Isma slung the laptop into her backpack, downed her coffee.
"You can walk to the supermarket with me."
During the short walk to the supermarket, she learned that he'd quit his job with a management consultancy and was taking some time to live life beyond office walls, which included visiting his maternal grandparents in Amherst, a town he loved for its association with childhood summer holidays. While she tried to choose between one variety of unconvincing tomato and another for tonight's pasta sauce, Eamon wandered off and brought back a can of plum tomatoes as well as leaves for the salad she hadn't intended to make.
"Arugula," he said, rolling the R extravagantly. "Halfway between a Latin American dance and an ointment for verrucas."
She couldn't tell if he was trying to impress her or if he was the kind of man in love with his own charm. When she had finished placing the shopping in her backpack, he picked it up from the checkout counter and looped it over one shoulder, saying he liked the schoolboy feeling of it. Would she mind very much if he carried it for a while? She thought he was making a show of the polished manners that passed as virtue among people like him. But when she said there was no need for such chivalry, he said it was the opposite of chivalry to burden a woman with his company just because he was feeling lonely and a London accent was the best possible antidote. So they continued on together, walking toward the nearby woods since the day was so lovely. On the way, he asked for a detour via Main Street. He said the name with a slight deprecation of someone newly arrived from a metropolis, so they could stop at an outdoor clothing store, and in little more than the time it took her to cross the street and withdraw $20 from the ATM, he was out again, wearing expensive walking shoes, the backpack more weighed down than previously. The woods were slushy, but the light piercing through between scrabbling branches was a pleasure, and the river, swollen with snowmelt, roared. They turned up their collars against the dripping from the branches. He didn't seem to mind yelping when fat, cold drops fell on his head, merely commented on the stylish protection of her wool turban and called her Greta Garbo. Every now and then they heard the whoomp of a section of dislodged snow landing on the ground, but they felt safe enough to keep going. Their talk was insubstantial, the weather, the over-friendliness of strangers in America, favorite London bus routes, which revealed nothing so much as the distinct geography of their lives. But even so, the Englishness of his humour and his cultural references were a greater treat than she would have expected. Small talk came more naturally to him than to her, but he was careful not to dominate the conversation, listening with interest to even her most banal observations, asking follow-up questions rather than using her lines as springboards to monologues of his own in the manner of most of the men she knew. "Someone raised him the way I tried to raise Pervez," she couldn't stop herself from thinking. Along one of the calmer stretches of water, a fallen tree extended out 20 or more feet from the bank. Isma walked across it, arms out for balance, while he remained behind, making noises that were half anxious, half admiring, wholly pleasing to hear. The sky was a rich blue. The water surged like blood leaving a heart.
A lean young man from a world very distant from hers was waiting for her to walk back to him. She breathed in the moment, tried to catch her reflection in the water, but it was too quick, nothing like the slow-moving waterways to which she was accustomed. She came from a city veined with canals that had been the revelation of her adolescence, while her school friends were embarking on other kinds of discovery that discomforted more than appealed to her. In Alperton, 2 miles from her old home, she could descend into waterside avenues of calm, unpeopled in comparison to the streets thick with noise she'd travelled to arrive there. She knew her mother and grandmother would say it was dangerous, a lone girl walking past industrial estates and along silent stretches with no company other than the foliage, as in the countryside. To her family, nowhere was more dangerous than the countryside, where you could scream for help without being heard. So she never said anything more specific than, "I'm going for a walk," which they found both amusing and unthreatening. Her foot slipped on the slick surface of the branch, and she had to drop to her knees to keep from falling in, the cold water a spray on her hands and sleeves. She walked back cautiously, registering the anxiety in Eamon's expression. After that, he asked more direct questions about her life, as though seeing her walk away from him across a fallen tree had brought her into focus. She gave him the easiest version. Grew up in North London, as he already knew because of the bus routes, the Preston Road neighbourhood to be precise, which was obviously too precise for him. 2 siblings, much younger. Raised by her mother and grandmother, now both dead, she'd never really known her father. She was here for a PhD programme, fully funded, with a stipend from a position as a research assistant that would give her enough to live on. She'd applied too late for the autumn semester, but her former tutor, Dr. Shah, had arranged permission for her to start in January, and here she now was. "And so you're doing what you want to be doing, you lucky thing." "Yes," she said. "Very lucky." She wondered if she should respond to his questions about her life with some about his. But then he might mention his father, of whom she couldn't pretend to be unaware, and that might lead them down a road she didn't want to travel. The river was dark now, the first indication that the day was ending, although there was still abundant light in the sky. She led the way back onto the road, bringing them out near the high school, where long-limbed teenagers were running on the outdoor track, piles of muddy snow pushed to the corners of the field.
"Can I ask you something?" he said. "The turban, is that a style thing or a Muslim thing?" "You know, the only 2 people in Massachusetts who have ever asked me about it both wanted to know if it's a style thing or a chemo thing."
Laughing, he said, "Cancer or Islam, which is the greater affliction?" There were still moments when a statement like that could catch a person off guard. He held his hands up quickly in apology.
"Jesus, I mean, sorry. That came out really badly. I meant it must be difficult to be Muslim in the world these days."
"I'd find it more difficult to not be Muslim," she said. And after that, they walked on in a silence that became more than a little uncomfortable by the time they were back on Main Street. She had assumed that in some way, however secular, however political rather than religious, he identified as Muslim. Though what a foolish thing to assume of his father's son.
"Well, goodbye,"
she said, as they approached the cafe, holding out a hand for him to shake, aware that the gesture was strangely formal only after she'd made it.
"Thanks for the company. Perhaps we'll run into each other again," he said, extracting his shoes and delivering the backpack into her extended hand as though that's what it was there for. Assuming women who wore turbans as a Muslim thing couldn't possibly shake hands with men. As she walked home, she thought how much more pleasant life was when you lived among foreigners whose subtexts you couldn't hear. That way, you didn't need to know that perhaps we'll run into each other again really meant, "I have no particular wish to see you after this." Auntie Nassim,
The neighbour who had taken the place of their grandmother when she died, and with whom Annika was now staying, called to say she didn't want to worry Isma, but could she check on Annika?
"She stays out so often now, and I thought she was with her friends, but I just saw Geeta, and she says the friends don't see her very much at all anymore."
Geeta of Preston Road was a link between Annika's home and university lives. A year older than the twins, and with a new stepmother who didn't want her around, she had a room in student halls, to which Annika had a spare key. Geeta herself never used the room because she was living with her boyfriend, though none of the older generation of Preston Road knew this. When Annika had first started staying over at Geeta's, because Annika was in the library or out socializing in one way or another until after the tube stopped running, Isma hadn't been happy about it. All those boys at university, whose families no one knew. And unlike Isma, Annika had always been someone boys looked at, and someone who looked back. More than looked, though Annika always guarded that part of her life from her sister, who was, perhaps, too inclined to lecture. It was Pervez who had talked Isma into accepting it. If there was anything worrying going on with Annika, he'd know, and would tell Isma if he needed backup in talking sense to his twin. But there was no need to start having nightmares about Annika out alone in the cold, impersonal heart of London. She'd always been good at finding people who would look out for her. There was an instant appeal in her contradictory characteristics. Sharp-tongued and considerate, serious-minded and capable of unbridled goofiness, as open to absorbing other people's pain as she was incapable of acknowledging the damage of having been abandoned and orphaned.
"I have you and P. That's enough."
Whereas Pervez and Isma stayed at the margins of all groups so that no one would start to ask questions about their lives. "Where is your father? Are the rumors about him true?" Annika simply knew how to place herself in the middle of a gathering, delineate her boundaries, and fashion intimacies around the no-go areas. Even as a young girl, she'd known how to do this. Someone would approach the subject of their father, and Annika would turn cold, an experience so disconcerting to those accustomed to her warmth that they'd quickly back away and be rewarded with the return of the Annika they knew. But now, Pervez was a no-go area too, and not one that Annika could confine to a little corner of her life. After the conversation with Auntie Nassim, Isma called her sister repeatedly, but it was late at night London time before she replied. The lamp at her bedside cast a small pool of light that illuminated the book resting on her chest, an Asterix comic, an old childhood favorite, but left her face in darkness.
"The migrants have a new car. A BMW. A BMW in our driveway. What next? A pony? An Arga? An au pair?"
When the tenants had moved into the house in which the siblings had grown up and replaced the net curtains with obviously expensive blinds that were almost always lowered, Annika said she sympathized for the first time with residents of a neighborhood who felt aggrieved when migrants moved in. The nickname had stuck, despite Isma's attempts to change it.
"I'm surprised you noticed. Auntie Nassim says she hardly sees you, and neither do your uni friends."
"I must really be behaving badly if Auntie Nassim is driven to complaining," Annika said.
"She's concerned, that's all."
"I know. I'm sorry. I don't mean to worry her. Or you. It's just easier being on my own these days. I suppose I'm learning why solitude has always been so appealing to you."
"I'll come home. Spring break is starting soon. We can at least have a week together."
The thought of London was oppressive, but Isma kept that out of her voice.
"You know you can't afford it, and anyway, you don't want to have to go through that airport interrogation again. What if they don't let you board this time? Or if they give you a hard time when you return to Boston? Also, I've got papers due. That's the main reason why no one's seen me. I'm working. The law makes you work, not like sociology, where you get to watch TV and call it research.
Since when do we lie to each other?
Since I was 14 and said I was going to watch Pervez at Cricket Nets, but instead I went to meet Jimmy Singh at McDonald's.
Jimmy Singh from Poundland, Jimmy Singh. Annika, did Pervez know?
Of course he knew. He always knew everything I did.
The night they discovered what Pervez had done, Annika had allowed Isma to brush out her long dark hair as their mother used to do when she had a daughter in need of comforting. And part way through, Annika leaned back into her sister and said,
"He never explained why he didn't tell me about the Ibsen tickets."
Months after their mother died, Pervez, a boy, suddenly arrived into adolescence in a house where bills and grief filled all crevices, had decided he needed a laptop of his own so that his sisters wouldn't disrupt his work on the sound projects that had recently become an obsession. One night, he sneaked out of the house when everyone had gone to sleep, took the bus to central London, and waited from midnight until mid-morning outside a theatre in the West End for return tickets to the opening night of an Ibsen play that an actor recently elevated via a superhero role to the Hollywood A-list was using to re-establish his credentials as a serious thespian. Pervez bought two tickets with money he'd borrowed from the household account using Isma's debit card, and quickly sold them both for an astronomical sum. He announced all this, sauntering into the house like a conquering hero, only to be confronted with his sister's rage. Isma's anger came from the thought of the overtime she worked to keep the debt collector from the door, and from the thought of every horror that could befall a young boy in a world of racists and pedophiles. But Annika's rage was far greater.
"Why didn't you tell me? I tell you everything. How could you not tell me?"
Both Pervez and Isma, accustomed to Annika's being the buffer between them, had been completely unprepared for this. 6 years later, that story was all Annika could grasp to help her understand her brother's subterfuge. Isma had an easier answer. His father's son. A fecklessness in the gene pool.
"Boys are different from us," Isma said. "They see what they want through tunnel vision."
The screen became a place of confusion, all motion and shapes, for a few seconds, and then she saw her sister lying in bed, face turned toward the phone that had been settled in its dock.
"Maybe if we start looking now for cheap flights, I could come to you for my Easter break," Annika said.
But Isma shook her head firmly before the sentence was finished.
"Don't want me telling the security monkeys at Heathrow how much I admire the Queen's colour palette."
"I do not."
Her muscles tightened at the thought of Annika in the interrogation room.
"Are we really not going to talk about the fact that Pervez has reappeared on Skype?" "If we talk about him, we'll argue. I don't want to argue right now."
"Neither do I. But I want to know if you've spoken to him."
"He sent a chat message just to say he's okay. You get the same?"
"No, I got nothing."
"Oh, Isma, I was sure you had. I would have told you otherwise."
"Yes, just that. He's okay.
He must have assumed I'd tell you as soon as I heard."
"That would imply he remembers how to think about anyone other than himself."
"Don't, please. I know anger is the way you express your concern, but just don't."
"Anger is the way I express my anger," she would have said on another night. But tonight she said,
"I miss you."
"Stay with me until I fall asleep," Annika said, her hand reaching toward Isma, swerving to switch off the light.
Once upon a time, there lived a girl and a boy called Annika and Pervez, who had the power to talk to animals. Annika laughed.
"Tell the one with the ostrich," she said, voice muffled by her pillow.
She was asleep before Isma was done telling the childhood story their mother had invented for her firstborn and Isma had modified for the twins. But Isma stayed on the line, listening to their breath, rise and fall together, as in all those times when Anika would crawl into Isma's bed, awakened from or into some night terror, and only the older sister's steady heartbeat could teach the younger one's frantic heart how to quiet, until there was no sound except their breath in unison, the universe still around them.
Chapter 2. All morning she pretended not to notice him sitting across the cafe basement, working on a crossword. But when she ordered a sandwich for lunch and brought it to her table, he came over and said he was about to have a bite himself. Would it be all right if he sat with her? "Preston Road," he said, returning a few minutes later with a plate of pasta. "It sounded familiar when you said that's where you grew up, but I didn't know why until I looked it up on a map. That's in Wembley. My father's family lives somewhere around there. I used to visit every Eid."
"Oh, really?" she said, choosing not to mention that she knew exactly where his father's family used to live, and that she also knew, as he seemed not to, that they'd moved away to Canada.
"There was a song my cousins used to sing to my little sister when the adults weren't around. I've had a line of it stuck in my head for years. Drives me crazy that I can't remember the rest, and my sister has no memory of it. Do you know it?"
Unexpectedly, he broke into a Pakistani pop song that predated his birth. He was 4 years her junior, she'd discovered.
She recognized the song by the tune more than the words, which came out as gibberish tinged with Urdu.
He sang two lines, softly, face turning red, a self-consciousness she wouldn't have expected, particularly given how pretty his voice was. She pulled up a song for him from the music library on her phone and watched as Eamon plugged in his headphones, unconscionably expensive. Pervez had coveted such a pair. He listened, eyes closed, recognition rather than pleasure in his expression.
"Thank you," he said when he was done.
"What does it actually mean?"
"It's in praise of fair-skinned girls who have nothing to fear in life because everyone will always love their fair skin and their blue eyes."
"Oh, yes," he said, laughing. "I knew that once. They sang it to tease my sister, but she just treated it as a compliment and made it one. That's my sister for you."
"And you? Are you like that too?"
He frowned a little, sliding the tines of his fork into the little tubes of pasta.
"No, I don't think so," he said, in the unconvinced manner of someone who isn't accustomed to being asked to account for his own character.
He raised the fork to his face and with little sucking sounds drew the pasta into his mouth.
"Oh, sorry, my table manners are usually better than this."
"I don't mind.
Do you know any Urdu?"
He shook his head, a response his singing had anticipated, and she said,
"So you don't understand Bay Takalufi?"
He sat up straight and raised his hand like a schoolboy.
"I do know that one. It's informality as an expression of intimacy."
She experienced a brief moment of wonder that a father who hadn't taught his son basic Urdu had still thought to teach him this word.
"I wouldn't say intimacy. It's about feeling comfortable with someone, comfortable enough to forget good table manners. If done right, it's a sort of honor you confer on the other person when you feel able to be that comfortable with them, particularly if you haven't known them long."
The words rushing out to cover how her voice had caught at intimacy.
"Okay," he said, as if accepting a proposition. "Let's be comfortable with each other beyond table manners."
He pushed his plate toward her. Extravagantly, she dipped the crust of her sandwich into his pasta sauce and leaned forward over his plate to bite into it. At the end of lunch, a lunch that was relaxed, swift-flowing, he stood up and said,
"See you here again one of these days? I've discovered that when the coffee machine is working, this place has the best cappuccino in town. I only have afternoon classes, and this is my favorite place to spend my mornings," she said.
In fact, she sometimes went to her second favorite cafe when it seemed too crowded in here, but really, what was the need for such fussiness? The siblings watched one another, and watched one another watching one another. At least it felt that way, though in all probability she was far more aware of the twins than they were of her. She raised her eyes briefly from the screen to see Eamon at a table neither too close nor too far away from her, so intent on some story in the local paper that he didn't take his eyes off the page even as he lifted his mug of coffee and drank. Existing in another world entirely from the one she now inhabited for these few seconds each morning at 11 a.m. Her brother had always been a creature of habit, and that at least was something to be grateful for. Else hours of every day might go like this, watching Annika waiting for Pervez to come online, then that moment when the green checkmark appeared next to his name, Isma wondering, what is he saying? Is he telling her something that will upset her? Is he asking her to become part of this madness he's joined? Oh no, please, he wouldn't do that, but why can't he just leave her alone? But every day, it was only a few seconds before his name moved into the offline column again. Just after, Annika would text Isma to say he checked in. Check in, one twin used to say to the other when there were school trips or sleepovers that kept them apart, and at some prearranged hour a text would arrive saying nothing more than checking in. When Parvez logged off, followed shortly by Annika, Isma felt herself released of the day's burdens and texted a steaming mug emoji across the room to Eamon, who in response went upstairs to buy them both fresh cups of coffee. This too had become part of the morning routine over the last week or so. Why pretend she wasn't keeping track? It was 9 days since he decided they should be informal in intimacy together. "What's happening in the world today?" she asked when he returned and sat down across from her, and he presented her his highlights of the local news stories. A bear was reported clawing at a garage door. Traffic in the adjoining town was briefly held up because of a 3-car accident in which no one was injured. A statue of Ronald McDonald was reported missing from a family's garden. She said it was clear the Ronald won gold medal for most local of the local news stories, but he disagreed on the grounds that Ronald was a global icon. Daily, after their 11s, he'd set off to wander by wheel and on foot, a Christopher Columbus of modest ambitions, retracing childhood paths and discovering new ones. He would sometimes arrive at the cafe the next morning with an offering from his journey, a jug of maple syrup from a sugar house, a $1 bill he'd found nailed to an oak tree with an oak leaf shape cut out of it, a rubbing from Emily Dickinson's gravestone, with its peculiar wording, called back, which he said made Dickinson sound like a faulty product. She learned more about this part of the world from his retelling than from her own living. But when she asked him the point of it all, imagining a travel book, he said surely experience and observation were point enough. What would happen when his savings ran out? She asked. And he said, actually, those savings he'd mentioned were his mother's. She had recently semi-retired and decided that people gave too much of their lives and relationships to work. While there was no talking her daughter out of her 17-hour days, she had quite easily convinced her son to try to find other ways of constructing meaning in life than via paychecks and promotions. Isma found this idea compelling, and Eamon's less than half-hearted pursuit of it disappointing. Surely he should be learning a new language, or piloting a ship through waters where refugees in search of safety were known to capsize in their pitiful dinghies. In the first few days, she had thought he might suggest they do something together past Elevens's. A movie, a meal, another walk. But she now understood that she was just part of the way he divided up his days, which had structure in place of content. Between morning newspaper and daily wander, there was coffee with Isma. Even the fact that spring break had now started and she'd made it clear she had time on her hands hadn't changed that. His father was often a topic of conversation during coffee, but always as my father, never as a man in the public eye. The picture Eamon conjured up of a devoted, indulgent,
practical joking parent, was so at odds with Isma's image of the man that she sometimes wondered if the whole thing were an elaborate fiction to disguise the truth about his father. But then she'd observe Eamon's unguarded manner and know this wasn't true. One morning, he was late to the cafe. She thought it was because of the weather,